You're listening to Buildipedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Buildipedia. Joining us today is a very special guest, Jan Vanderberg from Molfa, who's a development manager, as I understand. He can correct me in a minute. But Jan and I have worked before many years ago, and he's gone on to some great things. Welcome, Jan.
Thanks, Matt. Good to see you 15 years later.
So just by way of introduction, Jan, I hired Jan a very long time ago as a trainee. I guess you were a trainee project manager. And the notable thing that I remember was that I think we were in a bit of a growth mode and we were hiring quickly, and Jan turned up and didn't have a desk initially. And it didn't even have a space for a desk. But he took it. It was really, I mean, that was something, that was the first test. And I was like, well, buy yourself a desk and get yourself set up. And he took it in his stride. And I was like, yeah, okay, he's good. He'll do. But then that was a long time ago. And now you're at Molfa. And I described you as a development manager, but is that right? What is your role there?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, so very similar to project management, development management is kind of the same for development, but where project management tends to look at one phase of development, more normally delivery. Development management takes it right from inception when you're working out what this project is about, what is its brief, not only in apartment numbers and mix and things, but what do you want the purpose of the development to be, right through design, planning, sales, marketing, construction, and handover.
And you're the development manager of a substantial development. Like, you've definitely gone on to bigger and better things since we worked together. Because you're just, I mean, I'll let you describe what you're working on.
Yeah, it's been a 5-year journey and we're only the first stage in, but it's a $1.5 billion project in Norwest in Western Sydney. It's a site which will ultimately yield over 900 apartments across 9 buildings. We're designing delivering the first building now, which is 180 apartments. That's been 5 years to get to now, and we're looking to hand over that first stage end of next year. It's a project that's very close to my heart because it really aligns with my commitment to sustainability. We're trying to make Norwest Quarter the most ambitious zero carbon precinct, which, it's funny, the first project that Matt and I worked together was a zero emission house, and I didn't have any clue about what sustainability was back then, but I just
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, Chris Medlin's house, which he was a services engineer and wanted to make the best house he could. And I just loved the efficiency. I suppose my sort of passion for sustainability came from just like things should be done as well as they can. And then later having kids and then me wanting them to have the future that I had. So it's turned into sustainability being really important, and sort of was able to embed that into the project through the brief.
How important is that first major, like your first experience when we worked together at Youngkin Builders was that house for, Chris Medland, who's the owner of Medland, was called Medland Metropolis, now I think it's just called Medland. But so how formative is that first experience? You tell me and I'll tell you what my first project was.
Oh, incredibly. I think people come to development from lots of different angles, from construction, design, planning, valuation. I choose to go construction to sort of learn that craft, and being on site working with, they were craftsmen building these incredibly expensive, well-detailed homes where you're working with great architects, great craftsmen on site. It was incredibly formative, as you say. And then switching to development, you're going from $15 million homes to a position where you're interrogating absolutely every cost to make sure you get value. And what's really interesting is how little things add up. You can spec one really nice tap on a single home, but you do that 200 times and ends up being pretty expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. And my first project was at that stage at England and Moore House. And it was when England and Moore as an architect were at the peak of their powers, and they had this moment in the, I guess, early to mid 2000s where they were a powerhouse, and they fell apart a little bit in maybe, I don't know, around 2010, but in that moment they were incredible. And the house was very minimalist, tiled in basalt, and It's one of those, and it had very much, very much an architectural home in every way, and had bronze anodized aluminium, which no one used at that stage, but it became something that defined that home, was bronze. Everyone, every other home everywhere ever at that moment was using clear anodized. So he was a bronze anodized, but it was just exceptional in every way. And it was in the 2D times when architects drew incredibly intricate things in 2D. They never really bothered to, or they never really worried about what happened when those 2D sections met at a junction, you know? So that was my first introduction going, I understand that section. I understand that section. What the hell happens when those two meet in a corner? That's incredibly interesting, because I think that forced me to build mental models of things very quickly, because I had to, no one else seemed to care. Everyone else was like, go ahead and order the aluminium. And I'm like, hang on a minute, what happens? What am I ordering exactly? Because what happens in that junction? You know?
Absolutely. I could never underestimate how those site guys could visualize how things would come together. And I still remember learning that, as to, you can see something, as you say, a sectional detail in 2D, but how they then come together in the different planes of that space, it takes a fair bit of work to get your mind around to that. And like in terms of your point around innovation in small projects, I think developers are inherently risk averse, even though they take on a lot of risk. And a lot of architects kind of see one-off homes as kind of test beds of trying things different. And then they can learn how that works in a lower risk environment. And then they can replicate that on the larger projects. But they often love those smaller projects and continue doing those small homes while doing the really big stuff, because they can then draw that experience up.
And who are you working with right now on the, is it called Norwest Quarter? Is that the name of the project?
Norwest Quarter, yeah. We worked with two architects on the first stage. We've got two buildings in the first stage. The one building is 13 stories. That's with Smart Design Studio. It's an incredibly elegant building, all brick, curved balustrades and sloping soffits. It's a work of art. The scaffold's coming down probably around March, April, and that'll be a pretty special moment. And then the tall buildings, 23 stories, that's by Bates Smart. And then the next stage, we've got another two buildings. We're working with SJB, with Adam Haddow.
Yeah, yeah. And who's your favourite?
It's like picking a favourite child. I think the brick building is going to be pretty stunning. It's a real game changer for the area. It's fairly urban in its design, inside and out, and I think is really going to set the tone for the rest of the development. The Bates building is very good. It's got these beautiful precast columns, and then the SJB schemes coming about. We're in DA, but that's starting to look good too. So
very diplomatic answer there.
I think everybody's building's good favorite is probably going to be that first brick building by William Smart. That's going to be an iconic building.
Oh, look, he's an iconic architect doing iconic things. So yeah, it's certainly in our practice we steal a lot of ideas from William Smart all the time, but we look at his work admiringly.
In terms of that understanding of how things come together, when you've got a building like his where it is so incredibly refined that there's no room for error, so he's similar to the Renzo piano kind of design where everything's just so considered, I think it's going to look quite special. And the builder's done a really good job of actually executing on that design. It's a challenge because the architect has to be so steadfast in their design, because if you screw anything up, your eye's going to go to that screw up.
I've always told everyone that if your builder doesn't understand architecture, you got no hope. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I think so. And that's why we're trying to bring the builder on earlier. You've seen ECIs become more relevant, early contractor involvement, which I think you do pretty well as well. I think you can't get right involved in the beginning under design and construct, but getting the builder early to understand the why around design is so important, that they're not just saying, let's just change this thing, and they're not understanding how it works. It's very important.
Yeah, and like most people, what a lot of people don't understand is those minimal, those refined designs, they look so simple. But how much agony goes into making something look simple and cloaking everything? It's almost like conjuring a magic trick, because you've got to to create that simplicity, you've got to hide so many things into very small spaces a lot of the time.
Yeah, you look at some of the project homes and there are so many different materials and elements going everywhere. Your hiders are nowhere to go because you can hide up a lot of things that haven't gone well, whereas you look at a refined building and it does look simple, but it's not.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, tell me, we were going to ask you about your study tour. Like, what is a development manager doing on a study tour? What did you say? So, I'm just the novelty of it is extraordinary. I want to go on a study tour now. I'm wondering where I might go somewhere warm. But yeah, tell us, what is a study tour and where did you go? What did you study and what have you discovered?
So we went to San Francisco, to the States, to look at modern methods of construction, the prefab, for lack of a better word. So the federal government's had this great initiative where they've funded industry coming together with academia to try and unlock some of the challenges, particularly around housing and how we can build things better. So we went over there to have a look at, to talk to the guys at Stanford, Berkeley, and look at a few prefab companies as to how they were approaching it, because that whole Bay Area has a very similar problem that Australia has, and just, you know, incredibly low housing supply, huge demand. So affordability is a real problem. And you've seen, you know, the talk in the media around homelessness over there. And I think while we were there, there was SMH commentary around how Australia is kind of heading that same direction. So interesting how they're approaching it. I think prefab's been around for a long time and really struggled. We've seen so many businesses go under. And so what was interesting was that a lot of what they are doing by way of product is very similar to how we've done it, but their business approach was different. And one of the challenges there is that each local jurisdiction has their own building code. So where Australia, we've got the National Construction Code, it's the same code across the whole of Australia. There, every little local council has its own building code. So prefab's that much more challenging over there for them than it is Australia. Like, Australia is a very small market, but at least you can have one prefab supplier supplying to the whole of Australia, where they've got to adapt it to every little local council.
Can't Trump fix that? Can't he just...
Well, we won't go political. I'm sure he'll say you can.
Can't, yeah, Elon Musk, Donald Trump, one of those guys could fix that, surely.
Just build on Mars.
So, yeah, that seems, I mean, we take it for granted. I think a lot of the world is like that. We just live in a little bit of a bubble. We don't realize how good that is to have a standard code and a lot of things right across Australia and I think New Zealand, but very similar. But yeah, a lot of places around the world have that as a problem that, oh my God, like, yeah, we worry about so many things, but that's definitely not something that is probably underappreciated, I guess.
Agreed.
Yeah, and so what was, because we'll get on to, because we're, you know, I have an opinion about about prefab, but and I've done a bit of, well, I've done a lot of more reading and listening than I care to admit, but I really like the idea, because I love the idea of prefab, absolutely love it. It has just failed every time, and we'll talk about the reasons why maybe, but. Before we do that, what else did you discover? What are the things that surprised you that you didn't expect to learn? What did you find out?
I think the productivity in the construction industry, how it's one of the lowest there is across all industries, and that it's been falling over time.
Oh, you didn't know that?
No. The McKinsey chart that they showed was eye-opening, how we've just been going backwards. And I think what's my thoughts on it is that, you know, the complexity of construction projects and the sheer number of people that have to work on them to construct them is really adding to that. It's not necessarily the workers on site, but more on the design side. And particularly in Australia, the amount of people that we now need to technically review things, you know, that we can talk about the Design and Building Practitioners Act, the DBPA, but that's brought around all of these technical experts that need to review designs. You talk about waterproofing, passive fire, facade, all of these technical elements that need another specialist to sign off on, rather than historically the architect did that. The architect had a lot larger skill base. That seems to have shrunk a lot, and their willingness to take on risk and the insurance means that it's now been outsourced. So I think that prefab can assist with productivity, but it needs an environment where it can. So I think a lot of the time the prefab industry, particularly in Australia, has tried to solve for a design that wasn't considered prefab from the beginning, where they haven't had agency over design. It's just been there at the bottom of the funnel getting the designs and saying, can you try and make prefab work for this building? Where I think the successful ones in the States, and you look at, you know, the Scandi countries, how well they're doing it, they're completely integrated. You've got developer and builder and sort of embedded prefab production in-house. So the person at the top, the developer who's making those decisions, is driving down that mindset. And, you know, whether you do prefabrication of, you know, building it offsite or not, I think just having that mindset of standardization is really what unlocks a lot more efficiencies in construction.
Does that make buildings more boring though, if they're all kind of just, is that a problem?
That's a challenge. Absolutely. The challenge is how you make a box, what could be a box, still look beautiful. Australia's got such a big problem at the moment. It's so far behind in supply. We've got so much demand that I think over the next few years, we're going to have some real big problems with that imbalance.
So let's unpack that a little bit, because that's something that I've been trying to, how I operate is I try and create a mental model of what's actually happening and try and put it all together in my head. I can't work it out at all when it comes to, I can think about complex things, but I don't know, I can't add up. Something's not adding up, right? Because we've got an undersupply, but then we've got a price hike, but then property prices are not really surging in any way. It's very potluck, but most things, as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong or out of touch, because that's definitely a possibility, but it feels like property prices are pretty flat across the board. Interest rates are high, of course, constraining things. But if there was such a shortage, surely prices would be ticking up. And yeah, so what's the dynamic? Because the other thing I hear is a lot of developers are sitting on things because they're just not stacking up. So they're sitting on land because the build cost, the development cost and the build cost and the interest payments on the build cost don't stack up to a profit in their mind. So that means that, you know, we've got a shortage, but we've got a rental crisis, but is it really a shortage or is it just we're out of rental properties? We've got too many other properties. What's happening?
It is pretty complex and a lot of it doesn't make sense right now. I think we're dealing with so much more volatility than we have. Let's break it down to cost first of what a developer's had to incur over the last few years. So through COVID, we had massive material increases in cost. We had labor increase in cost. So developers, over the last 4 years, have endured somewhere in the region of 30 to 50% increase in construction costs. So an apartment that used to cost $500,000 to build, typical apartment price, is now costing $1 million just to construct, let alone all the other costs. We've got really low availability of labor. The industry is 100,000 workers in deficit. So that makes project durations push out because we can't get people to site, and then just higher costs because you've got a smaller pool of labor. We've got additional levies imposed. We've got councils, local councils, who are incredibly understaffed. And so you've got assessment timings taking longer, less certainty around when they're going to get approved. So developers are having to fund holding costs for longer and funding costs for longer. And then, you know, people that are selling land where sites have been upzoned, they're already pricing that into the sale of their land. So they haven't necessarily reflected the increase in cost to realize a 20% return. So that's the sort of the cost environment. On the revenue side, what we're selling these things for, we haven't seen them adjust upwards to reflect those increases in the cost. The only section of the market that we have seen that adjust is in the high-end downsides of product, where they've got the most price elasticity because they're sitting on, you know, very high value properties. Interestingly, they're struggling to downsize because no one can afford to buy their property, but still they haven't shifted back.
Their big property to shift to the smaller property. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why you've seen in the market that you have seen huge growth in that top end of the market. And those are the sort of the developers that are proceeding in sort of the inner ring Sydney. We do see, I think, more of that mid-market product being delivered by integrated builder developers. When I say integrated, you know, you think of Mervac, where they do both design and construct, or a Day Corp, or one of those guys. And they I suppose that they can better understand the risk involved because they have the coalface. But if you look at us, or you look at Sekisui or Frasers, they're outsourcing their construction. So they're removed from that. They're still very involved, but they don't have a true grip on that risk, and they're not willing to proceed with those projects. So those integrated guys are able to deliver. They're also international foreign developers that are seeking a lower return. But the market more generally, as I said, I think population growth is huge, supply is really low, and so we're not yet seeing developments proceed because the viability just doesn't stack up. The government's doing a lot in terms of planning. They're trying to unlock a lot, and they're doing a brilliant job of that. But still, it comes down to the development viability. And
brilliant job.
Yeah. Brilliant job. You're right.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. So, yeah. Never been used with government doing a job before, but all right. No, I get where you're coming from because, yes, they are, yeah, forcing through mass rezones where there should be mass rezones and there should be change and there should, you know, they're pushing the point. And I think that's highly commendable. But back to just pure fundamentals of economics, if we're so constrained, then why aren't prices going? Because if we're undersupplied, why are some apartments prices falling in effect? What's going, like, what, you know, why doesn't it follow? Because I think that's where it breaks my brain, is kind of going, well, I know supply and demand is a pretty well established economic theory. So what's breaking supply and demand in that context?
Where are all these people living I understand. Yeah, I think people will continue to not move while they can't afford. I think interest rates, as you say, they're just so high at the moment. So buyers can't move until interest rates sort of signal in the right direction. People continue to wait it out. And I think the media play a huge role in that as well, in that the media aren't talking about it yet. When they change, I think there'll be a huge influx of people. But in terms of where all of these people are staying, I'm not sure. It doesn't make sense.
I actually read a brilliant essay. I've had a brain blank on the name of the author, but he's I'll have to look it up in a minute. But it was called The Great Divide. It was in the quarterly essay, and it was very much the divide is those people who have a property and those that don't. So I think maybe part of the answer it might be that people who rent can't buy in, but there's not enough property to rent, but they're not. The rental return in and of itself isn't driving demand enough. I guess rent needs to go up a lot before yield becomes enough of a factor. So there's some sort of a lag between yield, which is the return you get from on a recurring basis. And there seems to be some sort of lag between those yields. So rents have to go up a lot more to then drive enough. And disproportionately so, because they've got to exceed that funding cost.
And Australia's interesting in that it's not particularly residential property. People aren't driven so much by yields. I think that plays into it, but it's all around the capital growth in Australia. And it's interesting how this is another thing that struck me in the States, where you've got so much entrepreneurship and innovation in a society where property isn't their primary wealth creation asset. It is creating your own business. And so people, there's so much more positivity and entrepreneurship that comes off the back of that. Where in Australia, so many people have an investment property and you're rewarded through negative gearing for bad decisions on a property that doesn't make sense because you're making a loss on the property. So you're making a bad decision. You're betting on the market going up.
So what's going to happen next? In your view, what's the word on the street? What's going to happen in the next 2 years? But what do most developers think will happen in the next 2 years?
I think we were all pretty aligned, and then Trump got in, and now that's thrown a bit of a spanner in our thinking. Who knows what's going to unveil over the next few months with his policy implications in Australia. Pre-Trump, we were all looking at an interest rate reduction early next year, and that being a signal to the market of interest rates, of the market being more positive. And I think there was an REA statistic that came out that said, I think it was a couple of months ago, that said 40% or over 40% of respondents thought that interest rates were going to continue to escalate.
Tell us who REA is, sorry.
Oh, sorry, Real Estate Australia, realestate.com.au.
Yeah, okay.
So you're in a market where almost half of people are sitting on their hands because they can't afford things now, and they think it's going to get worse. So I think once interest rates come off a little bit, that'll drive more affordability. It'll be a signal to the market. The media will jump on, and the media is so incredibly powerful once they start talking about this, which they're not talking about at the moment, the fact that there's such low supply that developers aren't starting projects, then I think the market will move. With Trump, it probably won't change things in the short term. I think interest rates, his impact on interest rates, it'll probably be more medium term. So I think once that changes, revenues will then be able to adjust upwards and developers' viabilities will stack more, because at the moment they're just not. I mean, we're having to charge such high prices and only downsizers are purchasing. And for developments to get up, to proceed, developers rely on pre-sales because banks still need pre-sales. They want to cover their risk, the banks. So they want pre-sales, and investors are the most likely to buy off the plan. And investors at the moment can't afford the interest rates that they're being charged.
Yeah, no, totally. And the thing that that I realize, well, it's like an inevitable death that will happen to everyone, but I was pretending that it wouldn't happen. My interest rates came off fixed, and oh my God. I knew it was coming. I knew for a while, but oh, that really, really stung. and there was just a time that I preferred not to think about it, really. But fixed interest rates are still coming off. Like that was, and I fixed mine for a 5-year term pre-COVID, so they only just came off now. And yeah, effectively my interest rate doubled overnight. So that's still coming. Like some people are still, I'm sure some people are in that zone where they're pretending it's never going to happen and then it does. So yeah, my spending and everything else has overnight has really taken a hit, but it is what it is. And hopefully they'll come off soon.
Yeah, that underlying capital value that you're applying interest rates, I think as you said to me offline, interest rates aren't that high. Like I remember when they were sort of, almost 10%, and that was considered kind of okay. I think what's happened though is that property prices have just surged so much. I think over the last 20 years, they've surged 300%, but wage growth has been a third of that. And so while the interest rates may be moderate, it's just, again, such a high underlying asset value that the amounts are huge.
Yeah, and amount of debt that people carried and took on. And, like when interest rates are 2%, it's easy to take on lots of debt.
During COVID, everybody down, they right-sized. Like they've moved to out of the apartment into the home. The household size shrunk. I think it went down a couple points. But how that then plays out in supply, it hurt by, I think, a few hundred thousand homes, just that shift in household size.
Yeah, absolutely. So costs inevitably. So here's the thing. For developers to come in to the market, costs will have to go up, rents will have to go up. So how does this actually help solve the crisis is people being able to afford rent. It feels like the crisis is the inaffordability of construction and the inaffordability of rent rise, but rent's got to go up inevitably one way or another because it has to accompany. So how does that happen when people are already stretched? That's the conundrum, isn't it?
It is. I think interest rates will help. I think even if rents sort of stayed at their point, just investors, their ability to cover that cost and betting on the market going up through capital growth could be enough.
Yeah. And so I guess the thing you touched on before, which is the elephant in the room, is cost, but also the compliance cost. I had a discussion a few weeks ago with an architect and a engineer. The engineer said that the new legislation helps protect consumers and it was really good. The architect said it's awful and adds 20 grand to the smallest renovation. How much of course I'm talking about the building practitioner, design practitioner and build practitioner legislation, which I am a build practitioner. I sort of understand it, even though I'm a build practitioner. Our practice is also a design practitioner. We have our other architects ringing us, asking questions about what it is and how much does it cost to implement. Everyone's a little bit confused. Like, no one really has a clear understanding of what's involved and how much it costs. But what in terms of the development industry, what are you factoring in for that change in legislation? What's the value per apartment?
It's significant. I think no question the industry needed a cleanup. I think the building commissioner has done an incredible job of cleaning up the industry because we need to have trust in the industry as a base. And so the Design and Building Practitioners Act definitely has done that. But the additional cost and time has been significant. Our project was one of the first to go through DBPA of a project of scale. There are a lot of consultants that really hurt through this phase, underestimating the time that it took. I think developers generally are sort of saying that it's adding their professional fees in the order of at least 20% onto their costs. I think on our first stage, you know, sometimes it was double the professional fees. And that was the learning. There was a bit of pain going through that first phase. But things are taking longer and there are more parties that need to sign off. I think the big thing is there's a lot of more technical consultants that need to review things. So where before, as we were saying before, architects had more agency over design, where now there's so much insurance risk against it that none of the consultants really want to move first and put something on the table because they are then liable for it.
Is there an estimate of per apartment? Is it per apartment, per square meter of apartment? Like, is there some notion of what the cost might be that has been added?
I'm not sure.
Because of 20 grand an apartment has been banned, 20 grand per apartment has been bandied around.
Yeah, I'd imagine it'd be more than that.
Yeah, it could be more
I'd
than
imagine
that.
Imagine more than that. Yeah.
Yeah, because you did say the commission did a great job. Was there a better way to do this than that 20 or 30 grand to an apartment?
Some of it is quite involved. I think the planning portal is still a bit of a mess. I think that's slowing down local councils. You know, when purchasers want to make a small change to our designs in the apartments, they're costing 5 grand for a PowerPoint. Like, that doesn't make sense. And it's because that everybody needs to update their drawings to reflect the little PowerPoint. And it's to capture the coordination. It's to make sure that everybody's got the same set of plans, the same position, so you don't have an opal tower where there isn't coordination, that everybody's on the same source of truth. But as you say, I think it's slowing down, particularly local councils, where every little change a developer has to make has to go back through a local council and they're not resourced up to deal with it. So potentially there's more agency for certifiers who are asking for every little change to be amended. And also the developer's ability to pivot market. As I said, on our first stage of Norwest Court has taken 5 years. The market was pretty different 5 years ago. Our ability to pivot and meet market is very hard to do when you're in that environment. The cost to pivot is huge because you've got to get the whole team to re-coordinate even further than you had done pre-DBPA. So it's definitely the right thing, but to continually meet market, it's very expensive.
So maybe there's another cost on top. That is that apprehension to be stuck in some, like there's a cost that developers, it's kind of development risk is increased in effect because you can't pivot, you can't change something. So that is actually, yeah, as important as just the cost of additional consultants and reams and reams of paperwork that are involved.
There's potentially lost value left on the table because you don't have the time to re-coordinate little changes and go back through council.
Yeah. I have to say I'm not a fan. I feel like there was so many better ways. It feels like, you know, when you get an engineer and you have lazy engineers and you have efficient engineers, it felt like it was designed by a lazy engineer who just threw everything in and added an extra 5 ton of steel for good measure and applied a common detail throughout the whole, you know, added cost the homeowner tens of thousands because they're a little bit lazy and should have really factored in.
Over-engineered it. Yeah.
I feel like it was incredibly over-engineered. As I was doing the assessment, I could almost feel the groupthink coming out of it and the compromises and the layers. Like it was a truly ghastly experience to do that.
I don't think the teams has helped. I think, you know, before we had teams, as in like voice, it's Zoom and the like, designers would get in a room and again have there'd be senior guys, they'd have agency to make a call on things and coordinate fairly quickly. I think you're a fan of your design sprint methodology, which I love, and just getting people in a room coordinating on the spot, where now it's kind of this football that gets thrown over, where one person designs a little bit, throws it over to the next, and you don't get that coordination happening as efficiently as possible.
Oh, look, there's no question that we design and build more efficiently when we have a team of architects and builders together. There's no question that it's more efficient to do it that way, to integrate, definitely more efficient, as long as you've got competent people, I guess, which I think we do. I'm very happy our team is highly competent. But yeah, I could just see the inefficiency and I think partly that is similar to my experience. I don't have experience in prefab, but I did a project with precast concrete, and that was extremely inefficient as well, because every PowerPoint, funny you should mention the PowerPoints, but every PowerPoint had to be planned into a precast panel and the conduit that leads to it from another place that was convenient. So yeah, we found that all things considered, we should have just done in situ, I think. Would have been a better result, faster, all things considered, and probably more cost effective, because the headline cost was great, but all the time in the pre-planning and the replanning and the adjusting and the supporting, and I think that dissolved that initial efficiency. But so I'm jumping around a little bit, but I do want to come back to prefab, because we're totally a little bit at loggerheads, a little bit aligned. I mean, we're aligned and we both like the idea of prefab. I just don't think it will ever work as a cost-saving option. Like, or if it is, it's like sort of flying cars, where it's always in the future. And even Toyota had a crack at it. And I don't know if you're aware of that or if I shared that with you, but Toyota had, or still probably has, a division that builds homes. But they are elite home. They are luxury homes. They set out to create cost-effective homes. They set out to build the Corolla or the RAV4 of homes, but it's definitely Lexus. Like, they definitely ended up at Lexus. And I think that's the case in a lot of places. A lot of European prefab is high spec. And will it ever be a solution to a housing crisis, is my question.
I think a housing crisis, firstly, is a housing crisis at all levels. So I think all levels of the housing market's undersupplied. So yes, prefab may not solve the bottom end of the market, although they are trying. If you deliver at one end of the market, not necessarily uber premium, but somewhere, it should then flow all the way. I think that prefab, at best, in a super optimized environment, could have cost savings. It will have program savings, but I think that its biggest advantage is providing greater certainty in design and quality outcomes. So development's pretty risky. You've got so many different variables that, and hence you got to charge a pretty big risk premium, say 20%. But if you gain design certainty from a prefab solution, you could potentially reduce your risk-adjusted return. So I think, as I said before, when you have that integration of developer, builder, prefab, they've got agency over that design to say, we are going to have this way of thinking. And even if you don't do full prefab, even just adopting that way of thinking of having more standardized product and not every development being different, I think that will unlock a lot. But prefab also needs scale. Part of the reason I think it's failed in Australia in a few instances is because it has tried to respond to a developer's design. The government's trying to do a lot. They did a fair bit with schools infrastructure. They're now trying to do something with homes. And that could be a really good catalyst for the industry in driving that sort of base demand of a standardized product. And if we try to create housing, private housing off the back of that, that is more repeatable, still beautifully designed, but more repeatable, that could give the prefab industry a scale that it needs to scale up to meet that demand.
So are you saying government subsidize that scaling up, or what are we talking about exactly?
I think more through Homes New South Wales, they've got a mandate to supply, I think, 4,000 homes over the next little while.
Oh, so public housing? Are we talking
public
about
housing? Yeah. Social and affordable housing, more social housing. That if they were to make those prefabbed, the prefab industry would scale up to meet that demand. That would get the utilization of all of that plant. Like, you think of a prefab company, it's got a huge amount of capital that's required to set up all of this plant. And like a car factory, it only makes sense when it's pumping out cars and the same stuff, not stopping, retooling for a different design, punching that out, retooling, punching that out. So if you can get its utilization up, then those things start to make sense. And I suppose going back to the design part, that's what I'm really passionate about, and working out how you can make a design which lends itself to prefab. You know the outcome you're going to get. You can price that better because you know what the design is. You know how much it costs. You know how long it takes to build. There's less risk involved in that. And if you talk about typologies, you could do that as small as a duplex, and there's an existing compliant development pathway. Government's now starting to talk about a pattern book, which is a templated apartment building, say 3 to 6 stories, that if you design to that template, you can have a faster development approval pathway. So if we design an apartment building that's, say, 3 to 6 stories that fits a certain site profile, there's so much less risk involved because you know what you're getting. The same as you've bought a project home. A project home is a pattern or templated home. You apply that thinking to a denser typology.
Yeah. And so is anyone doing a prefab pattern book? Is that something that is happening or will be happening, you think?
Behind the scenes, there are talks of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Watch the space. Yes. I think there's, I should say, in Victoria, they tried it. It was called the Future Homes Initiative, I think it was called. The issue that they had is that it was completely design-led, being more sort of aesthetic design-led. It wasn't truly integrated with industry. It wasn't developers working with this. It wasn't prefab industry working to make sure this thing was viable. So they produced a whole bunch of great designs that never got built because they weren't viable. So now I think the opportunity for government architect, the pattern book, is do it more integrated. You know, create a design that developers know they can build, that the market wants to have, that they want to buy, that builders know are efficient to build.
Well, my understanding of, because people have studied, prefab's been around, I mean, Jorn Utzon was into prefab before he designed the, or shortly after he designed the Sydney Opera House. So it's been around for a very long time. My understanding is that it's the cyclical nature of the industry that tends to kill prefab, because you have, and that coupled with rent, because you're paying, you're doing a prefab home, you're paying rent at a factory somewhere that maybe you're not paying if you just mobilize a team to come to site. And then you store, you know, you're storing and then you're moving. But I think what's killed most prefab companies is just that downturn when you just, you need to keep paying the rent and paying the wages.
Absolutely.
And so it's that, like, I guess the exception where prefab has somewhat succeeded is probably the Eastern Bloc countries in the sort of 70s and 80s or even earlier, because the government was the client. So there's a lot of what look like prefab buildings where the blocks are just stacked on top of each other. Not always attractive. Traditionally not very sound in terms of comfort or anything else. A lot of those blocks, and I know from going back to Poland recently, a lot of those apartments are now coated. The ones that are still around have an external layer of insulation on them because they were never that comfortable or efficient.
You're right, but the cyclical nature is the challenge for them because they've got this facility, it's charging rent, they've got workers sitting there, they've got plants sitting there. So one of the interesting business models that we saw in the States, which was actually a UK example, was where they looked across all government agencies as to what they were building. Their procurement teams, what are they building? What are the commonalities between them? What are the same wall elements or floor elements? And how can we get a kit of parts across all of them to kind of work that counter-cyclical nature? So if Resi's going, then maybe fiscal spending isn't that high and vice versa, which I thought was quite clever, and trying to get that base, again, procurement from government to then have an industry. I think in prefab, it's a pretty big spectrum as well. You've got full Monty volumetric, which is, you know, you make a whole apartment offsite, you come and you drop that box on site. You then can step down that to, say, a CLT panel, you know, a timber panel that you see in Barangaroo that's constructed on site floors, walls. And the same you could do for panelized floors and walls, that you can make them offsite, crane them in, the thing goes up in, you know, days, not many months. You can then have that thinking come down to just using the existing frame and truss industry in a more smart way, or even as you've spoken about, the parts that you put inside the building, not everything being bespoke, trying to get your rooms to work to standard joinery elements or panel sizes. So it's a big spectrum, and it doesn't have to be full volumetric. It can just be that way of thinking of more standardization.
Yeah. And I think that's probably the thing. And I guess our little segment of the industry is architectural homes. So and we're in a heritage conservation area. So a lot of,
NIMBYism.
I was thinking more like we're just trying to squeeze something in where it wasn't ever designed to squeeze in, and we're playing all, you know, we're conjuring all sorts, we're pulling out all the tricks to make it fit. And every 100 mil is incredibly important.
Yep, absolutely. And Sydney's land prices are so high, you want to squeeze that lemon as much as you can to get every bit of yield out you can.
Yeah, but also just the practicality of trying to make something work where it shouldn't. So it's probably not as much about yield as it is about creating something in a space that it was never supposed to fit into. And a lot of the time you get kind of pushed back, and you not so much. I don't experience a lot of NIMBYism. It's probably more overzealous planners and ineffective planners and planners who are not empowered to make decisions, trying to fit something in and through their prism. Yeah, but I wonder if you could standardize something, you kind of need a little bit of a pass to go that extra to enable you to create something bigger than maybe you would have otherwise been approved to do if you can show efficiency. So I wonder if there's a claim that you can make where if there's an efficient methodology for building and you're everything's in 300 increments, say, then you can get something a little bit bigger than you otherwise would have because you're showing. Of course, that games the whole system with architects going, I've worked out a way to make it 300 mil bigger because we're over by, you know. So, but I think that sort of thinking is required where everything is cut to size. If you can reduce some of that, I mean, I'm going to have a go at, I haven't told my wife yet, but I'm going to have a go at, with our new renovation, trying to leave off paint and leave off setting and paint and just see what happens.
It's coming. It's coming. The paint is coming.
No. Not like that. No, more like, this is a really interesting look, isn't it? You know, but I've used moldings where and left them unpainted but maybe we'll paint them later. I don't know. Maybe. But, you know, I'm just thinking in that way of reducing what drives up cost is the number of people that have to come and the number of phone calls that a builder has to make to get those people to come.
Absolutely.
And so our cost strategy is a little bit upskilling everyone. We've got people on hand who can do a number of tasks. For example, every labourer in our organisation knows how to lag a pipe, right? Because to sit and wait for someone to come and lag a pipe, and it's a job that is, yes, there's a little bit of art to it, but it's patience and some basic skills, but it's not hard. It's probably hard to do very neatly, but it's not hard to do. So there's jobs like that. And no one ever sees the lagging in a residential setting. Maybe in an industrial setting, you see the lagging.
Yeah, it's labor, as you say. It's reducing labor on site. Australia has such expensive labor. It's a great society. It's a great economy, but it's got such a big middle class. It doesn't have, like the States have, the Mexicans and cheap labor coming over. To construct, we've got incredibly expensive labor. So if you're going to reduce labor cost on site through those connections and just like having very simple connection details, I think there's huge opportunity there. The material prices aren't going to really come off, and they're sort of more commodities. It's that how they come together on site.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of people outside of construction, when they want to solve construction related problems, focus on material supply, and you just go, you're not going to out Bunnings. Like, you're looking in the wrong place for economy and improvement of economy.
Yep. And for a slight sustainability benefit as well, the more you can have things put together on site with standard connections, the easier they are to kind of pull apart at the end and potentially reuse them later. So we love the work of Jeremy McLeod from Breathe Architecture in Melbourne. He founded the Nightingale housing model. He's got a great online resource around materials and not only the selection of materials that are easily able to be reused later, but how you actually fix them. And so he's, you know, very much against glues and timber flooring. He wants to fix those timber pieces to the battens, or use stainless steel bench tops rather than reconstituted stone, because you can more readily reuse stainless steel. The same for any fixtures in their place. So
he needs a guard at the entrance of the site confiscating Sikaflex. I was involved in a project that wasn't supposed to have any glues, or and everyone was always smuggling in Sikaflex, because it's such a habit. Just squirt a bit of Sikaflex here and there, just to so they were smuggling it in.
And that expanding foam that fills any void.
Yeah, but I think that's hugely. I have to actually get him on the podcast, and because we've got a lot of common thoughts, and we've definitely. But I think for like one of the things that I can see straight away in terms of cost is just quantity of people to coordinate to drive across the city to get, like, if you could just reduce. If you think of reducing one person on each site driving on every day, like, that's a huge saving. If you can multi-skill, because that's the problem. Everyone's got their skill set and everyone's risk averse in construction. So they're not willing to do anything other than what that thing they've been hired for and they're good at. They all know how to do a multitude of things. And I just think you're better off sometimes getting people to widen what they do, because there's no point them spending 2 hours on your site and then going to another, driving across town to another site and then if you can get people to do a bit more. And I think in commercial, they've worked that out, because you get companies that do everything from doors to gibrock or framing, internal fit out businesses that do all of that. And it's the same, a lot of the times, the same guys who are doing the door as the doing the gibrock framing, metal framing, timber doors. So they already do that in commercial to an extent. And I think that's our sort of strategy, is to multi-skill and upskill all of our guys. And we think it's good for them anyway, because they'll understand more of, as they go on in their career, they'll understand more of what happens in construction. They can jump in when someone's not available and do something. Or they're in a better position to coordinate that trade if they've actually executed that work in the past. So I think cross-skilling is something that's probably underrated, but then it's because intuitively it flies against that old notion of division of labor is the most economical thing to do. You know, if you break the production of a pin down into 100 tasks, it'll cost less per pin. But I think that's been applied to construction, but maybe bluntly. So I've lost my page. You can ask me a question now.
I was thinking back to that first site that built in Dover Heights, and you're right, the guys were craftsmen and they knew what the other trades did. They could jump in and do any trades work. And so we had a whole bunch of guys that were employed directly by us to just keep the site moving, that we didn't stop when someone didn't turn up. So it's an opportunity. It's a difficult one to crack. We have so few people going into trades as it is, and that's just one discipline. But there's definitely a loss of that craft of building.
Yeah, but it's a conundrum, right? Because you're kind of going, okay, on the one hand, we want craftsmen. On the other hand, we want to standardize things and make think less cutting and let's say, you know, so I always kind of think of the two sides of my brain are arguing with each other, because you want to up the craftsmanship, but then you at the same time you want to economize and to some extent prefab at one extent, or a Peter Stutchbury crafted house at the other end of the spectrum, for argument's sake, where everything's timber cut to size and panels and everything's crafted, or a lot of it's crafted by hand. So you kind of go, well, the more you move towards prefab, the more you standardize, the less craftsmanship. So you're kind of going, well, it's tearing itself apart. No wonder it's confused and going backwards.
Yeah. I think you will have, with prefab, you can have less people on site that should be across more of the trades, and they're just going to be the integrators of the different parts arriving on site. So you may have the tradesman moving on site into more a manufactured environment where it's more predictable and those prefab companies could hire them directly rather than subcontracting out, and they've got more certainty of just punching the same thing out and then you're just connecting them on site.
And so, Will, when is prefab the cost-effective alternative in your mind? What has to happen and when is it likely to happen? We'll replay this in so be careful what you say.
20 years from now. No, I think it needs to be in an environment where all of the stakeholders are aligned on sticking to...
Oh, you're such a developer. Aligning stakeholders.
I think discipline's the word, right? Like, you've got to be disciplined to stay to the parameters that prefab need to work in. And then you need the scale. And I think the scale's unlocked both through those maybe base load government projects, diversity in projects, and the planning pathways that will support a standardized product. I think that, as you say, in the inner ring, Sydney, prefab doesn't necessarily work because you're trying to get as much value as you can. In more of those middle to outer ring, land values aren't so high. They're more greenfield development or a little bit larger, that they're more viable. I think that also the NIMBYism and council subjective approvals hurts prefab because prefab needs to stay standard.
It hurts a lot more than prefab, I can tell you.
Yeah, too much politics in local government, I say. I think the state's doing a good job. But yeah, it needs to stay standardized. So it needs an environment from everyone to allow that to happen. And planning is a big one.
Yeah, absolutely. So hang on. Have you actually answered the question, or is that less than training to be a politician? So when I want to know when.
Development's very multifaceted. There's a lot of levers to move, and who knows when they're all going to move at the same time. Yeah, there's no silver bullet.
Buzzwords all over the place. Tell me the year that it's going to be the cost-effective solution in your mind.
There are a lot of initiatives happening now that I think it'll really start to gain momentum now. Tell me the year, son. No.
Yeah, I don't look. I guess that's my worry. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. Is it's flying car, driverless cars, nuclear fusion. They're always, no matter what year it is, somehow always in the future. And prefab homes, cost-effective prefab homes. And can we even hit the scale in Australia? Can we even get scaled, or are we just, are they going to be made, is it pods that come from China, Vietnam, India? Is that inevitable?
China's, at the moment, they don't quite have their heads around the NCC, the construction code in Australia. They are making pods that I think they do it through it's essentially a caravan. It's above the ground, so they're importing it under that. Once they do, I think that's got a huge opportunity to have scale outside of Australia. As you said, Australia is a pretty small market. It has the advantage of one construction code. So if you solve once, you're solving for the whole of Australia. I think that China will definitely play a big role.
Yeah. So prefab housing, is it shippable internationally, or is prefab housing in your mind, is that a barrier? Can prefab be shipped, or are we limited to specific pods that fit into a container? Like, what's the...
We've shipped. So we made, on two projects for Malfa, we had Malfa own Hayman Island up in Queensland. We wanted to put 15 cabins onto Hayman, and we built them in Campbelltown out here. We wrapped them, put them on the truck, shipped them up, or truck them up and then ship them across to Hayman. Short distance, I suppose, to get across. We also did the same Malfa own Bimbadjan wine estate. And so I think they're about 40 cabins that we built also in Sydney and delivered them to those sites. I think regionally also it's got a really good opportunity because regionally they have even less of those availability of resources. So,
but would they fit on a standard container ship, or are they special? Like, are they oversized?
Probably not a full volumetric apartment, but definitely the bathroom pods. I think bathrooms, they're probably the biggest overlap of trades in one little space and the highest amount of defects in one space as well. So if you solve a lot of the other stuff in Australia, even just bathroom pods, of which there are really two really good companies that supply bathroom pods here. They've been doing it for a long time. They really help with the quality and the time in those areas.
So are there developers doing like a standard, well, conventional development, but putting bathroom pods in effectively.
Absolutely.
Is that what you're saying?
Yep. Yeah, of scale. It needs repeatability and scale.
Yeah. That's the thing. That's where that my story about precast concrete, it just wasn't a scalable thing. It was four houses and they were all slightly different, and it was just a little bit different, but not too much. So they all kind of looked the same, but marginal differences really hurt.
Exactly. There's an interesting story of Lendlease. Lendlease went off on a journey to have integrated prefabrication. They bought a whole bunch of facilities set up to do all of this great prefabrication, bathroom pods in particular.
Yeah, and Lendlease have the benefit because they're a developer and a builder and an integrated design team, right?
Exactly. What their challenge was, though, that their prefabrication group started out, and they looked at all the Lendlease projects and distilled it down to a handful of bathroom pods. It said, these are the most common, you know, pretty much all of our developments use these. We can produce these. But then each different department started pivoting little changes, and they went from 4 to 8 to 16. And I've seen the chart of it just growing, that it became completely inefficient, that the bathroom pod facility was having to retool every time. So it needs that agency over design and that alignment between everybody.
Yeah. You know, when you have a high-rise tower, those little changes are huge margins, right? And I know this because I know from an unnamed source that when they were building Crown Tower, and maybe this is common knowledge, I don't know, but I won't say who it was because maybe they shouldn't have told me, but in effect, Crown Tower reduced the number of lift shafts they put in because of the yield. So that's why it took a lot longer to build and was insanely frustrating for everyone involved, because they limited the number of service lifts, because for every one lift less, there's that additional yield at, it was some insane price, 50 grand a square meter or some of that order.
Over 100, yeah.
Yeah. So they reduced the number of commercial lifts in the spaces and made it incredibly difficult to fit off. That's why I remember scratching my head going, this is taking longer than it needs. It's still happened a lot quicker than that, the infamous hotel that took longer. Yeah, I remember
took some changed hands a few times.
Or changed builders a few times. But certainly sent two builders broke in the meantime. But yes, Crown Tower took a long time because of that yield per square meter meant less lift space, less commercial lift space. They made a decision. It's going to take longer, but we're going to make more money. And the poor subcontractors had to. Probably that, you know, inadvertently, probably that never, I don't know that they're that conniving, but certainly inadvertently passed on some of the costs to the subcontractors who were constrained in movement of material and, yeah, potentially lost money because of they didn't factor that in enough. But yeah, I don't know. That was another rabbit hole that I took us down. But look, I think that's probably an interesting spot. The Crown Tower is an interesting spot to wrap it up, but I've really enjoyed the chat about prefab. Like, we're both prefab buffs in one way or another. You're just an optimist and I'm a skeptic, but we're both intrigued. So it's interesting because we're sort of two different parts of the same coin, but I think we both want prefab to succeed. I just don't see a path for it, whereas you do see a path for it.
Yeah, developers have to be optimistic, otherwise nothing would ever get built. So, yes, forever an optimist.
Absolutely, forever an optimist. And look, really appreciate your time. So, Jan Vandenberg from Molford, thanks so much for your time, and really appreciate you joining us. And, all the best with Norwest Quarter, which is due for completion in...
Spring next year.
All
going to plan, yeah.
It's going to be
an incredible precinct, so definitely come and check it out.
Yeah, I'm waiting for an invitation to come out there. And so I'm ready. I remembered you mentioned that I could come and have a look. So, yeah.
Definitely come and have a look. No, I'd love to show you.
Yeah, I'm coming. I'm coming out. All right.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Thanks for being with us, Jan. Thanks to our listeners. To access exclusive content, we invite you to join our community by subscribing to our mailing list. The link can be found in the show notes. So thanks again. This has been Buildopedia.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.